because the intelligence world is hemmed in with all sorts of strictures with regard to maintaining the secrecy of its product, what tends to happen is when something like the Tiananmen matter, the crackdown in the square in Beijing in 1989 occurred, CNN has that out on the airwaves almost instantaneously. And CIA, working through the bureaucratic channels and with the controls dealing with classified information, can't compete with that.
Reinventing the CIA on this edition of Common Ground. Is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. The Central Intelligence Agency benefited greatly from the global Cold War conflict with the Soviet Union. The work of individuals in the CIA was rarely publicized, but the agency as a whole was glamorized in the movies and spy novels of popular culture. The world appears no less dangerous following the Cold War, but the CIA appears slow to respond to the new challenges. Here to talk about this with us is Dr. Marvin Ott, a professor of national security policy at the National War College and a former CIA analyst. He recently wrote an article for Foreign Policy titled Shaking Up the CIA.
The CIA, after all, was created as an instrument of the Cold War. It was created at the beginning of the Cold War to provide a instrumentality for the U.S. government, which did not exist before, to deal with organizations like the KGB, to pursue the contest in the shadows and in the back alleys, as it were, with a totalitarian adversary, but also to collect the kind of information that was necessary to understand the capabilities and the nature of the threat that that adversary posed, information that was not available through public means and was in fact deliberately hidden. So one definition of the CIA's mission was to collect that information which other governments, adversary governments, were trying to prevent you from collecting. This is an institution whose whole raison d'etre was the Cold War. With the end of the Cold War, there's a really profound question. I mean, it's not a trivial one, as to why do you have to have a large intelligence capability to deal with a world in which your principal adversary ceases to exist? And that is not an easy question to answer. Not so much a question of whether the CIA should continue to exist. That, with occasional exceptions like Senator Moynihan, that is not seriously debated, I don't think. But the question of how large, how capable, and how expensive, i.e., what kind of budget the CIA should have, that's a real question.
In January of this year, President Clinton addressed the CIA employees at the Langley headquarters, and in the speech he said, quote, "I look to you to warn me and through me our nation of the threats, to spotlight the important trends in the world, to describe dynamics that could affect our interests around the world." Does that sound like an adequate charge to the CIA?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's adequate on a high level of generality. The problem is if you're trying to deal with an oversight committee and an appropriations committee on the Hill trying to justify a budget, you've got to get a lot more specific than that. I mean, the essential response on the part of the intelligence community to why should you continue to be a major enterprise in a post-Cold War environment is a fairly obvious one in a sense, and it's simply to say that the world remains a dangerous place. The Soviet Union, yes, that is gone as the adversary we knew, but the threat from international terrorism and narcotics and proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and ethnic conflict and a whole host of sort of lesser, more regional, more limited threats is very real, particularly if you take seriously the notion that the United States has some kind of responsibility don't call it a world policeman, but call it some kind of responsibility as the lone superpower to use a sort of social science jargon, system maintenance. I mean, to be responsible in some degree to be the force for stability and order to the extent that such a force can exist, and to underpin UN peacekeeping operations and that sort of thing. If we are going to take on that sort of responsibility, we're going to be engaged in a lot of places. We're going to get in harm's way in a lot of places. We're going to incur the wrath of a number of lesser adversaries. And that's going to require intelligence. If you're not going to blunder into situations that you could avoid, if you're not going to incur casualties that you could avoid, you're going to need the best information you can get.
You know, in a recent article you wrote for Foreign Policy, you pointed out many of the CIA's problems and suggested some courses of action. But you also go into some detail about the Reagan administration's attempt to trade arms for hostages with Iran and how that revealed deep problems in the CIA. Can you just describe that for our listeners?
Yes, there were two perhaps specific episodes that tend to highlight the nature of the problem. And all of this comes under the broad rubric, to use the term of art, of politicization, i.e., the charge or the accusation, the allegation that intelligence analysis was distorted to fit the predilections of senior officials or to fit existing policy. So in other words, rather than having intelligence be an absolutely honest, call it as you see it, enterprise, that the analysis was trimmed to fit the bureaucratic and sort of policy needs of the moment. I'm off on a slight excursion here, but if I can just pursue it for a second, that's a very serious charge, because even if it occurs rarely, which I think is true, it does only occur or has only occurred rarely, nevertheless, once it becomes known that the system is vulnerable to that, then the integrity of everything the system produces is put into question. And it's particularly acute when you need fearless performance by your intelligence agencies the most, when the policy stakes are very high, when careers are on the line, when the risks are real. That's when you want your intelligence agencies to say, this is our honest best judgment, and if we're delivering bad news, so be it. This is what we think. If, on the other hand, your intelligence agencies begin to trim and to modify because they know that the message they're bringing is one that, for whatever reason, senior officials won't like, so they sugarcoat it. Once that becomes known, then the credibility of your product is heavily undermined.
When you talk about taking the product to senior officials, who do you mean? Who are the senior officials? The CIA or elsewhere in the executive branch?
No, this is elsewhere in the executive branch. The CIA its reason for existence is, to use the quotation, policy support. The CIA exists to provide information and analysis based on that information to senior policymakers. This means in the State Department, the National Security Council, in the Pentagon, and other agencies of the government as needed. So what we're really talking about is the credibility of CIA analysis to assistant secretaries, deputy assistant secretaries, to the secretary himself, Secretary of State, and comparable level officials elsewhere in the government responsible for foreign policy and national security policy. Now, in the case, coming back to your question, in the case of Iran, this was in the context of the whole Iran-Contra episode during the Reagan administration. And as your listeners will probably recall, there was a school of thought within the national security apparatus of the White House that there existed within the Iranian leadership quote-unquote moderates who could be approached and who could be bargained with to, in the first instance, to achieve the release of hostages, being American hostages being held in Lebanon. In the course of pursuing that policy initiative, various analytical products were developed, including a national intelligence estimate. And when I say a national intelligence estimate, this is the highest level product that the intelligence community produces. It is a product not just of the CIA, but a joint product of the various components and other agencies of, that make up the intelligence community, a collectivity. And it represents the estimate represents the best judgment of the collective wisdom of the various intelligence agencies pointed at a particular problem. And this particular estimate was, excuse me, was drawn up, was drafted, as all estimates are, by a member of what is called the National Intelligence Council, which is a body that coordinates the, this multiple agency input for the community as a whole. The product, however, argued that there was in Iran a group of moderates that could be dealt with along the lines that the White House was looking for, which was would be fine, except that that was directly contrary to the view being held by the Iranian specialists within the CIA, who were the most expert people the intelligence community had on this problem. Now, in the way the system should have worked, if the national intelligence officer, the man who was drafting this particular report, if in his view, as an expert also on the region, there was in fact a moderate element that could be dealt with, as the White House hoped, fair enough. But he should have made it clear in the estimate that this was not a view that was held by the working analysts within the CIA. Quite the contrary, they thought that was an entirely erroneous analysis. And the National Intelligence Officer who drafted this particular estimate, which then went to the White House and was very influential in terms of policy because it tended to buttress what the White House wanted to do, the National Intelligence Officer didn't do that. And so the White House, reading the document, had no way of knowing that there was, in fact, a major dissenting voice within the intelligence community. And in fact, if you said, what is the preponderant analytical view within the community? The preponderant analytical view was, in fact, directly contrary to what was in that estimate. That was one instance. Another, just very briefly, in pursuit of this policy, the White House enlisted the assistance of a former CIA operations officer and took him along on the famous trips that went to Iran with the cake and the key and all of that. He was brought along because he was expert on Iran, and importantly, he spoke Farsi, the language that they would be using in dealing with Iranian officials if they weren't using English. That was fine as far as it went, but this man established his own channel for collection and analysis directly to the White House. In other words, he acted as an intelligence collector. He observed, he elicited information, he then acted as an analyst, he wrote that information up, drew conclusions from it, and he then conveyed those conclusions to the White House, all without informing the analysts within the working levels of the intelligence community, particularly CIA, that he was doing this. Therefore, for example, on the question of the Soviet policy towards Iran, there was a major difference of view, and a similar problem occurred as in the other case, of the case of the estimate. The fact that there was a strongly contrary view within the intelligence community on a major issue involving Iran was never conveyed. And in fact, the working analyst didn't even know that this separate channel of intelligence was in fact going to the White House. It's those kinds of problems. And once that became known, then there was severe disaffection within the analytical ranks, great rancor, lots of bitterness, and a cloud put over everything that the agency did, or that the intelligence community did on Iran. And just a final point on this, and George Shultz at one point in his very good and very lengthy memoirs recalls a conversation with Robert Gates, who was the director of Central Intelligence, saying, Bob, I don't believe a word you guys tell me on Iran because you've got an axe to grind. You are not reliable. And that's the price you pay. One, you know, here you have the Secretary of State deciding on a major area of intelligence concern and policy concern that the CIA and the intelligence community were, in fact, not to be trusted.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with Dr. Marvin Ott of the National War College. He's also a former CIA analyst. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. In your article for Foreign Policy, you point out some of the other problems with the CIA, some other concerns at least, and I'd like to have you just elaborate on some of them as I mentioned them. Senior officials in Washington seem to hear about major world events from CNN before they hear about it from CIA.
Well, this is a tough problem, and I think one has to have some sympathy for CIA on this point, in that what's happened is that the other means of communication, I mean, National Public Radio being one example, but particularly CNN has become sort of representative of this, have become so good at reporting fast-breaking developments from all sorts of obscure corners of the world that it is hard for the official information-gathering capability of the government to do better. And because the intelligence world is hemmed in with all sorts of strictures with regard to maintaining the secrecy of its product, what tends to happen is when something like the Tiananmen matter, the crackdown in the square in Beijing in 1989 occurred, CNN has that out on the airwaves almost instantaneously. And CIA, working through the bureaucratic channels and with the controls dealing with classified information, can't compete with that. And so you have repeatedly, you know, the attempted coup against Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, a whole series of examples where I cite one instance where a friend of mine who heads a little consulting firm here in Washington whose wife is at the CIA, on a number of instances they would compare notes at the end of the day. And my friend who was the consulting firm and the CNN on his desk knew about a series of breaking events sooner than his wife sitting out at CIA did. And that is more than anything else simply a product of the fact that the public's media has become so good and so pervasive.
All right. Another item you mentioned is that CIA personnel responsible for certain countries or areas have never traveled extensively, sometimes have never traveled extensively in the place they're analyzing intelligence about.
This, I think, has been a serious problem, and there are efforts underway and have been for the last couple of years to try to at least ameliorate this problem. But essentially, my argument is that the CIA is a very insular and cocooned sort of place, and that typically what happens is if you look at the profile of CIA employees, these are analysts in the Directorate of Intelligence, the DI, they tend to be people bright, very capable, but who have come directly out of a graduate school, probably out of a master's program. Maybe they studied international affairs at a major university. They then go to the CIA, and that's where they then live for the rest of their career, essentially. And it tends to be a very confining sort of existence, including the degree of exposure they have to the countries that they are responsible for analyzing, assuming they're working on some geographic area. So that you have, for example, I cite one instance is back, and this is not unusual, during the Cold War days in the 1980s when you had a person who was the principal analyst responsible for a Eastern European country who had never been in that country and who didn't speak the language, had no direct exposure at all. Well, that's particularly difficult when that person is responsible for producing the analysis that comes out of CIA on the country in question, which is then going, amongst other places, to the NSC, National Security Council, and there the principal reader is a former ambassador just back from the same country who had spent 3 years there, spoke the language, knew all the senior officials, none of whom the analysts had ever met. And it is terribly difficult for the analysis that comes out of CIA to be credible under those circumstances. Now, that's somewhat of an extreme case. I mean, typically, your geographic analyst will probably have visited at least the country in question. But also typically, it will be very brief. It'll be a three-week orientation trip. And in all probability, he or she will be very circumscribed because they work for the CIA, and that's sensitive. They'll be very circumscribed in terms of where they can go, the people they can meet, what kind of contacts they can develop. And my argument simply is that if you have a core of an analyst, no matter how bright and how capable they are, if they're essentially living in an antiseptic world of government cubicles and electronic data, reading their information off a computer screen, that is not the same and is not a substitute for having lived in a country, gotten your shoes dirty, you know, gotten drunk with some of the locals, you know, heard their war stories, developed friendships, gone to school there, gotten sick there. I mean, there is an irreducible difference between having firsthand experience in depth, months of experience, living in a country on the one hand, and being a desk-bound analyst on the other. And by and large, the CIA analysts have had relatively little of that kind of in-country experience, and that hurts, particularly when they are producing product, analytical product, for example, for the State Department, whose people are out in these same countries all the time, and they are living out there, and they speak the language, and they know the people. And it is very hard to be credible and useful to a policy audience of that kind if your analyst doesn't have comparable experience.
That brings me to another problem you brought up in the article, and that is an inadequate link between the analysts and the policymakers.
Yes. One of the, I think, you know, severe difficulties, and it's something that if you haven't been out at the agency and sort of been inside it, it's hard to appreciate. Is the and it's related, is the degree of isolation that characterizes the analyst from the rest of the government. And this is a natural product of it being the CIA. This is the Central Intelligence Agency. It's a secret organization. It exists behind high walls and electrified fences, and you have to have special access and security clearances and so on just to get into the place. And that's the environment in which you work. And if you're an analyst, your world tends to be circumscribed by the walls of the CIA. Despite the fact that you are nominally engaged in policy support, quote-unquote, what really happens is your world is circumscribed by the people you work with and the people you work for in the agency itself. And analysts tend to have no real sense of working for policymakers because they don't deal with policymakers. They don't see policymakers. They don't meet them. I'm exaggerating slightly, and there's been, again, an effort in the last couple of years by CIA management to try to increase the amount of contact and get analysts out of the building into contact with policymakers. But still, by and large, it is very insular, and analysts see themselves basically working for themselves, for their file, for their boss, for their peers, basically for a very small in-group in the intelligence world itself. The sense that they are really working for someone at the State Department or at the NSC or the Treasury Department or the Commerce Department or the Pentagon, that sense is often not there at all. And so that insular sense, that lack of contact with policymaker, that lack of experience on the ground in terms of geographic expertise, tends, along with other things, tends to reinforce a gap or a pick the right metaphor, but a separation between analyst on the one hand and policymaker on the other, and the notion that the analyst is a sort of close-in, intimate support to the policymaker is largely a fiction.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time, and the final question I wanted to ask you, if we don't have a post-Cold War mission or a plan for the CIA, but we do know that it's going to get smaller, and that seems to be a budgetary reality, and you suggest that that's not necessarily so bad. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would argue that, and I do argue in the article, that the DI is too big, and that's reflected.
The Directorate of Intelligence?
Yeah, the DI, the Directorate of Intelligence, the analytical arm of the CIA, is too large. And that's reflected in the fact of all this layering. It's reflected in the fact that if you look at assignments that analysts have, they tend to be slicing the pie of the subject very finely, which suggests that there really are too many people working some of these problems. What the right number is, I don't know the exact number. In a sense, nobody does, because it really depends on what kind of assignments, what kind of tasks the CIA is going to be given, and what kind of environment it's going to be working in. But I suggest in the article that perhaps something on the magnitude of about 20% cutback is probably would be a good thing. And in fact, budgetary pressures emanating from the Congress are going to force a cutback, probably something of that magnitude. So this particular reform, if you want to call it that, is likely to occur sort of in the nature of things. I might just also add, just looking ahead of one sort of final comment, that it's very important, and it really comes back to your first question, it's very important that the CIA, the oversight committees of the Congress, which establish the budget for the CIA and oversee its activities, come to some kind of a consensus as to what the real mission of the CIA is. Where does it fit into the national security enterprise? You know, what exactly do we expect of it? Because if you don't have that, then the relationship between these oversight entities and the CIA itself will inevitably be a very acrimonious one, because the CIA will come in basically trying to defend this budget, not to defend the mission, but just to defend its survival and the preservation of jobs and that sort of thing. And the oversight committees will tend to cut away at that budget just because they're trying to cut budgets, not because they have some sort of mission concept that they're trying to orient the CIA to fit. So if the relationship between the CIA and other components of the government, but particularly the Hill, is to be a sort of constructive one, we've got to develop a consensus as to what the mission of the agency is in the post-Cold War.
That is Dr. Marvin Ott, a former CIA analyst and professor of national security policy at the National War College. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9415, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9415. To order by credit card, you can call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. However, to order cassettes or transcripts, please use the toll-free number 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.